We gotta turn ourselves in.
Wait, what?
They're all gonna show up. If we run, they're gonna shoot us.
What do you mean? We're gonna just go to jail?
It's better than getting shot, ain't it?
I don't feel good.
Babe.
Oh, God.
It's an Italian prison. You know the food's gonna be incredible. We'll have meatballs and pesto sauce and all that.
It's not co-ed, honey, all right? We're not gonna be in jail together.
I know. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm one of your curators, Devin Decker, and joining me, my curation companion, Sijin Sarawick. Sijin, welcome to our latest expedition. How are you doing tonight, my friend?
As always, I am just ecstatic to talk about this movie. I'm excited to be here with you. I thank you, of course, once again for bringing me here. And we have a real piece of Masterpiece Theater tonight. Mystery Masterpiece Theater, even.
Yes, it's to be remembered along the echelon of Christie and Johnson, Ryan Johnson, of course, because we're talking about Murder Mystery this week on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. We're continuing with Adam and it was fun seeing Jennifer Aniston the first time. It was fun. I don't know. Just go with it. You know what we didn't mention? And this is my favorite part about doing it in these seasons and everything.
Yeah.
The weird obsession with Sting music in that movie for, like, no reason.
Oh, man. Yeah, you know, he gets into some music jokes in this one, too, and it's, that are pretty fun.
Yeah. But that's why I'm like, oh, yeah, man, like the Sting train, it did not keep a rolling, thank God. But, yeah, we're rejoining Adam Sandler, working with longtime best friend, perhaps best platonic female friend, Jennifer Aniston. And we're going to Europe for a murder mystery.
Yeah, yeah. And I got to say, like, right off the bat, like, it shows. Like, this is clearly a movie that was made by a couple of friends. I'm trying too hard not to laugh too much because there's a lot of, like, really goofy bits in this movie that I really do appreciate.
I don't disagree with you. The chemistry on display between Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston is top notch. And it's very nice getting to see them working together from the beginning instead of having a whole will they, won't they kind of just like shoehorned in there because that's what movies do.
Yeah, we got kind of into that for a while where we were into the established relationship romantic comedy. Like, I think the other big one that I think of is Date Night with Steve Carell and Tina Fey, right?
Interesting intersection to take us through because I've never seen Date Night, but this movie really reminded me of Date Night.
Oh, man. But there was a time period, right, where we suddenly, like, we wanted our romantic comedies. And you know, Apatow even leaned into this because he went from making movies like Knocked Up and 40-Year-Old Virgin, where it's all about, like, guy meets girl, to This Is 40, where it is guy and girl that have been together for 20 years, right? Like, he's, like, we even see it in some of the bigger names making romantic comedies where they lean into this trope of, like, no, they've been together for a while, but it's about the idea of quote-unquote reigniting the spark. And you know, there's a lot of humdrum that comes with that trope that we can kind of get into later that I actually think this particular movie avoids a lot of some of the seedier, more upsetting parts of that kind of storyline. But yeah, Dev, I had you seen this one before?
I had never. This was my first time seeing this film.
Okay.
This film is a real delight, but I'm going to do a little bit of housekeeping for the whole show proper, in my description of this film and how I feel about it. See, the first six films that we looked at in our first season, those were films that, like, we were pretty sure those were going to be a connected cinematic universe for Adam Sandler, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'll put the soup right on the table. I was nervous doing Just Go With It. It was a movie that I wasn't really ready to talk about on a show called the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. And the reason for that is that it obviously does not exist in that shared cinematic universe. So it's kind of difficult to have that discussion. But now that I've ripped that Band-Aid off, I'm ready to dive right in to Murder Mystery. And I could end the episode right now by saying, this is not a part of a shared cinematic universe. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good night and a rest of your day.
I think it's worth us exploring, talking about, and seeing if we can find the ways in which, like, maybe this is... I mean, you know, this whole thing is about him going on a trip to Europe, you know, him and Jennifer Aniston running away to Europe. So maybe this is the movie that takes place in Europe in that universe, you know?
Maybe. Maybe like, this is
the other side of the pod.
Yeah, I mean, we're still going to have the discussion, obviously. It's just, I'm now more comfortable as somebody approaching this whole project, this whole idea, with looking at a movie and saying, no. Yeah. I'm not going to jump through hoops. I'm not going to try to figure it out. I'm not going to wring my hands because there's like one shared element between another movie that Adam Sandler showed up in.
We're not going to force it in, right? Like, right. We're not going to push a square peg through a round hole. Like, that's just not the point of the show. And quite the opposite, right?
Yeah. And again, it's our star chart of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
There you go.
Your mileage may vary, but I came to this film and obviously I'm carrying some of the baggage from Just Go With It, seeing another Jennifer Sandler and Adam Aniston film. But really, it was so easy to rip the Band-Aid off and be like, no, this isn't one of them. When can we start watching the Drew Barrymore films? And it was interesting, but you're not wrong. We're still here to discuss it. We're still here to talk about it. And I'm excited to do that. I mean, that's the whole reason why we do the podcast. But yeah. I kind of wanted to get it out of the way because it was immensely freeing to be able to identify what a loss is in this adventure.
I think that this movie, though, more than just Go With It, has a lot more of that Adam Sandler universe stank on it. You know, we talked a lot with Just Go With It about how it didn't feel like it was a very Adam Sandler movie. It felt very much like Adam Sandler kind of came in after the fact, right? And I don't feel that way with this movie. I mean, you have some over-the-top characterizations, you have some really silly events that happen, you have him just wanting to be doing things that he's always just wanted to do. I mean, car chase at the end of the movie, going to Europe, like the playing what must be a version of his mother and father, right? Like this was, there's a lot in this movie that feels like there's a lot more Sandler in it than Just Go With It. I'm not completely ready to write it off yet. I'm definitely there with you that there is not a big connection that makes me go, boom, this is why it has to be. But there is definitely enough going on in this movie where, like, especially when we get later into some of the other movies that we talk about and we expand things a little bit, you know, it's not so close to Little Nicky at all. No. But is it close to something like I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry?
Ooh,
and is that movie in the right? Like is there like maybe a through line that leads us to this one?
I don't know.
I don't know.
And that's what we're here to figure out. That's the whole point of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. And I'm excited. I'm excited to get to look at this film, a film that I had never seen, but a film that my parents had seen. The rare Adam Sandler film that my parents, like, were familiar with. I say rare. It's the same thing that happened with Just Go With It. So, really, all I have established is an Adam Sandler cinematic universe that's Devin's parents friendly.
films he does
with Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah, I'd seen it pretty early on in its lifespan when it came out on Netflix and had watched it on a date night, and it was completely serviceable as like the romantic comedy of that night, right? Like we'll talk more about it after our usual hullabaloo.
Yeah, after we fuff around for a bit. So is that with that, do you have any facts and figures on this, or should I jump right into the synopsis?
So we once again run into the issue of this being a Netflix film. So obviously, like, facts and figures are kind of hidden away. But it does this movie does present an interesting conundrum that we should kind of parse out now, because it's not going to be the last Netflix movie that we talk about here, nor on the show proper and all that. Right. The number for this movie that had floated around in its first weekend, it was number one for days. In fact, I think it was number one for multiple weeks. Number two is already on the way, like greenlit, and they're it is go. So like, look out for that. So it's success, right? Like, clearly Netflix deemed it worthy of a follow-up and all that. But the number that had been floating around was 30 million people had watched it. Now here's the question. When Netflix says 30 million people, do they make an assumption on like a three-person home and only 10 million homes watched it? Do they make an assumption that like one viewer, we're just going to call that one person, and you know, maybe they shared it with 10 people that night, maybe they didn't? Because that, like, Netflix saying 30 million people watch this movie is very different than like WB or Disney saying that, because WB and Disney literally have a paper trail, right?
Right. I guess I naturally assume that when Netflix says 3 million people watch this, they mean 3 million users.
Yeah.
And but you're not wrong. That is an interesting thing, especially since so much of the latter day Adam Sandler, like, oeuvre, yeah, is all on Netflix.
Well, and to that point, a lot of his movies are much more either family-oriented or date-night-oriented. You know, this isn't like when I was tracking down Billy Madison and I knew that I was probably the only one in the house that was going to want to watch it, right? Like, saying that I was watching Murder Mystery again, there was a moment where I was like, do we want to watch it as a family? Because, like, I watched it before with one person in this house and we enjoyed it, you know, thoroughly. So it is a date movie, right? Like, the assumption that this is a romantic comedy, pretty often watched on evenings when there's more than one person around. So there's, and then, you know, like I said, you get into some of his family fare. I'd even point to something like Pixels, not a Netflix movie, but like, if I ever put Pixels on again, it's probably not going to be watch on my lonesome, right? It's going to be at a party. It's going to be when somebody's around. It's going to be when family is there and they need something that is fun but safe for the kid. Like I'm never going to not watch that movie by myself ever again. And so, like, it's an interesting idea that with these Netflix movies, and that's the number that comes out, people are like, you know, they can guffaw at that kind of stuff all they want, but really, does that mean 60 million people? And then if you translate that to what that would have been in box office, like, that those numbers start to get really interesting.
Yeah, it is something very strange. And you also, with the information you've just provided, really fixed one of the problems I had watching this movie the second time, which is not as good the second time, which is an unfortunate thing for mystery movies. Either you're going to notice the small little clues that you were supposed to pick up on the first time through. Like, they tell you straight up that the butler did it, and then they give you everything to be able to solve this one beforehand, and that's fun. Right. But it can also ruin the second viewing already knowing what's going to happen.
Well, it's the difference so let's talk about mystery movies for a second.
Yeah.
And mysteries in general, like mystery stories and all of that, because so many mystery movies are really just adaptations of, you know, Agatha Christie and things like that. But the idea being that that is the difference, at least for me, between a good mystery and a classic, like a great mystery, is the idea that even though I now know the answer, it is still something that's interesting to watch. So, I mean, my favorite one of all time is going to always be Murder on the Orient Express. And that's just going to be because, like, the ending to it is just so phenomenally, like, balls to the wall. Like, Agatha Christie just being like, fuck you all in the formula. like
we're talking the original, right? Not the remake with Daisy Johnson and Finn.
Well, so the Kenneth Branagh one is...
Daisy Ridley, sorry.
Daisy Ridley, yeah. The Kenneth Branagh one is, I mean, interesting. But I mean, like, that, it doesn't change anything about the story. Like, did you think that they changed anything?
No. I'm just wondering. But there are some people that staunchly defend the original and have just a pure hate hard-on for the Kenneth Branagh remake from a couple of years ago.
As somebody that's no fan of Kenneth Branagh, like, I've got some real issues with the way that he adapts things. I have to say that his Murder on the Orient Express is one of the more exciting movies that he's made, and I am actually looking forward to if and when Death on the Nile ever comes out, a movie famously shelved because of COVID and mysteriously never heard from again. So it might be one of those ones that we suddenly lose to time, and everybody just remembers, like, wasn't that supposed to come out? I think Murder on the Orient Express is a fantastic, like, a great mystery, because even though I now know the end of that movie, watching everything up to it is still really good, because there is so much of Poirot in that story trying to figure out the whodunits and seeing him get things wrong, which is so rare and stuff. Like there's a lot of really good stuff in that that is fun to go back to no matter what version, no matter what time, right? Versus something like there's, you know, an episode of Law and Order. Like I don't, there's not much meat on those bones. So once you kind of know who did it, there's not much joy in going back to it, you know? So what is in this mystery, right? Is there enough meat on the bones of this mystery to make it kind of worth it? And I think that that's where it's benefited mostly by the comedy. And so, like, that's what makes it worth going back to this movie a second time, is the goofiness of it all. Because you're never going to not remember the ending of this film. I mean, are we spoiler alert for this entire
podcast? This whole podcast is a spoiler alert. We're here to discuss the film.
So, like, the reveal at the end of the long-lost daughter, and then eventually the secondary reveal of the guy that you thought couldn't speak English the whole time. Like, those moments are just... That's what I remember about this movie, right? Like, the things that I forgot are, like, the little conversations that they have, like, taking the shrimp away after... and then he says to her, grab the cocktail sauce, and she's right there with him. She's like, uh-huh, and she grabs it and storms out behind him. Like, that moment got me this time, and I'm sure it got me the first time, right? Like, that's the stuff that kind of keeps you coming back. And... You know, I'm not going to sit here and say this is the funniest Adam... This isn't even the funniest Adam Sandler movie we've watched for this podcast. Like, this is just... It is not the highest caliber of his work in terms of the comedy. So, like, saying that you didn't enjoy it as much the second time, I totally get that. Because the only thing that really would save it would be the comedy. And the comedy is fun, but not memorable.
Right. Well, that's where you bring in that you watch it with a person, that it's a date night film, that then a bunch of memories also become, like, part of the Christmas tree that is Murder Mystery in your kissing. Memories.
There's a lot of scenes that you can miss because you're kissing.
Because, yeah, exactly. So, yes, you could have been distracted. Yeah, yeah. This is it. Yeah. Nothing's going to happen in this scene.
Exactly. Right. And so that... Yeah, like you said, like it is a reason to come back to this, is to have somebody else watching it with you, for sure. Yeah. The other thing is we have talked at one point in the past, and I can't remember if this was Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe or Say Report, but I did talk about how I discovered how Netflix kind of tracks these things, and the idea that the company that's responsible for this kind of viewing and tracking of these numbers, one of the coolest things to me that they track is when a movie is stopped and if it's picked up anytime within the next, like, few days. So, like, if you start this movie on date night and then you get distracted and don't finish it, but you come back to it, like, 2 or 3 days later to finish it, like, they note that. And that is actually, depending on the situation, I guess they try not to spin it as positive or negative. They just want to let you know numbers-wise this happened. But I would assume that they would see that as a positive, that it was good enough that even, like, something caused them to have to stop at this moment, but they came back, is a pretty good metric, right? And so
honestly, I
wonder how much of that is
in think that's a better metric than they watched the whole film. They watched 20 minutes of this film, stopped for some mysterious reason, and then 2 days later, they watched the rest of it. Means that they were hooked by those first 20 minutes. Something just happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the story is so intolerable they had to watch it in chunks. But, you know, that's a different...
Yes, it could go both ways. It's...
Right. That's what I mean. It's like, But that is what I mean, is when they say they probably try to divorce themselves from any, like reading on what the numbers mean. But that is part of what they report to Netflix, and then Netflix takes that and they determine what they feel about that. And so that 30 million homes, that 30 million eyeballs, whatever the fuck that number they want to, whatever noun they want to put at the end of that, that's the number that they would float around when this movie first came out, you know, and much to the detriment of so many different critics that wanted to rip this movie apart, because it falls firmly at that point in Sandler's career where just ripping him a new one every time a new project comes out is worth it, until it's a movie that is deemed worthy, like Uncut Gems, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an interesting number that got passed around. Other than that, I don't have anything more as far as hard, cold facts.
What about you? You mentioned critics. Did they rip this one apart? Is this one that they were harsh on? Because I don't know. I don't know how you could be. It's so inoffensive, this film, in a lot of ways. Like, there's obviously, we're going to talk about it as we go further down. But, like, as a whole, this is kind of a wholesome, like, fun movie that the whole family kind of could watch if it came down to it.
Yeah, yeah. So RogerEbert.com, we've gone to before. They don't put fancy review names or anything like that. They just murder mystery, 2 stars. Like, that's, then, you know, the review is just says, like, it's a serviceable film, but it doesn't do anything exciting enough or worthy enough for them to talk much more about. But Screen Rant gets a little bit, Guardian gets a little dirtier, where they say, murder mystery, the film that asks, what is Jennifer Aniston doing? And then they rip into, like, the idea that she dares to be in this film. And then they talk about it in the context of other movies that she's making around this time, like Horrible Bosses and Where the Millers and stuff. And, like, what is she doing with her career as she makes $3 million a rerun of Friends? She does whatever the fuck she wants, is the answer, dude. Like, and then the IndieWire probably has the meanest one that I found, which was Adam Sandler's latest Netflix debacle is his laziest movie to date. Like, those are that's the kind of attitude that this movie gets when it comes out. That being said, like, all of these people then give it middling reviews. They give it like a 5 out of 10. They give it a 4.5 out of 10, right? Like 2 out of 5 or 2 out of 4 in some cases. Like, so I'm not saying that they're being hypocritical. They make it sound like they hate this film and then talk about how just mediocre it is the whole time. And I think for a lot of people, that is actually worse than just being like a bad movie, right? Like, for a lot of people, at least if it was bad, that it was watchable is like the kind of the concept, right? But it doesn't fall into that. It is well made. It is funny when it means to be funny. It is mysterious when it means to be mysterious. It's just that it doesn't try to be anything more than what it is. It didn't try to break the bank. And I think that's Sandler's MO, you know, especially late in his career. Is like, he's not there to make waves. He's not here to win awards for the movies that he makes. Even when he does something like Uncut Gems, he doesn't make that movie because he's like vying for an Oscar. He does these movies because he wants to. He wants to work with these people. He wants to be doing this project, or he wants to go on vacation to Europe with Luke Evans. You know, like, he just wants to.
I mean, imagine going to Europe with Luke Evans. The things he could tell you.
I mean, listen, considering the fact that he narrates 90% of this film, like, yes.
Yeah, none of it, Luke Evans' things were scripted. That was all improv based on his knowledge of Europe. That's a lie. This show presents itself as semi-academic, so that is fictional. I'm just making a joke.
I will tell you, though, if you told me that everybody was improvising and his improv was just to point at things around him and talk about them, I would believe that. Oh. Like, this character's doing this right now. That character's doing that later. That character did this once, and you're just like, thank you, Luke Evans.
Her entire body has been recreated from the bottom up by a little-known surgeon, Danny Maccabee.
There it is. There's your connection.
That's what I was waiting for. I was waiting for Dr. Maccabee is very pleased. Like, I'm like, just like that. Like, enough to connect these two films. And they really were. They were living in my mind at the same time, which is, it's not fair to either of them. However, I think the big takeaway is, just go with it. Wow, this is a legitimate film. I still felt the same way about Murder Mystery. That, like, this isn't a stoner comedy. This is the kind of movie that grandmas probably see on their own.
Yeah, no, it's definitely much more, it's got more mass appeal. That's what you're looking for. Like, this is, you know, and Netflix is, man, 2019 for Netflix is a weird year, because in that year they've got Murder Mystery, but they also have that weird Ryan Reynolds, like, I call it a flop, but it was more of like experimental film, Six Underground, where like half the CGI is not done. You literally see him standing in front of a green screen at one moment.
Well, I've never seen that movie. I'm familiar with it. I just,
it is like weird because everybody, you know, it's like there's a movie happening and people just forgot that it was, they were like, shit, it's going, it's out tomorrow. We didn't finish it. but that's also the year The Laundromat comes out. The like really weird, like, Steven Soderbergh-esque, actually, did he produce it? Probably. But like the semi dramatic retelling of those guys that like laundered all that money with Bill Nighy and Antonio Banderas, I believe, playing the two of them.
Yeah.
Or Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas. Sorry, not Bill Nighy. The other old British guy that could do no wrong.
I knew Antonio Banderas was there. That's what I was supporting.
But yeah, but like, so that's the year that we're talking about for Netflix, like, as well as a bunch of other stuff that, you know, because they're never not throwing things out there. Yeah, like, so in terms of mass appeal, like, Netflix is kind of like pedal to the metal, like trying to just get things out there that they know are just going to be bringing people in so that they can just say, like, we've got the originals, we've got it. You know, like, you may not love it, but you don't hate it. Pay us more money. Like, that kind of attitude is pervasive, even to this day with Netflix.
Yeah, and you're not wrong. And you also mentioned that you're not trying to win awards. And I think that that is a perfect thing to say about these Adam Sandler Netflix films, because he's just trying to have enough appeal that Netflix will continue to give him the opportunity to create for them, right? Mm-hmm. He has found the golden goose, and he does not want to overfeed it no matter how good the foie gras would be.
Yeah, no, he knows what he's doing. I mean, like, he's happy to be making movies at just the right level, that he is not going to make waves, and they're going to keep letting him make movies. Like, that is fully the attitude that's on display here. And I some people, I think, really dislike that. They mm-hmm. feel like if you're not making movies to make fine art, or if you're, I mean, not really, that's what it is, right? Is if you're not making movies to make fine art, failing or otherwise, like you're not, what are you doing? And, you know, that's not what he's about.
No, and that's not what Hollywood is about either, right? Hollywood likes its art from October to January, to December, really. And then everything else, we just want to make as much money as possible.
Well, allow me to steal a phrase here, but maybe the reason that a lot of people then take issue with what Sandler's doing is that he's saying the quiet part out loud, right? Yeah.
I don't disagree. And just for the finale of this whole thing, this did win the People's Choice Award for Best Comedy.
That's awesome. So, that's good. I did not see that at all in any of my...
Like, when I saw that it won an award, I assumed, like, maybe Golden Raspberry or something like that. And then to mm-hmm. go and see, oh, this won Best Comedy at the People's Choice Awards. Good for you, this film. Good for you, Murder Mystery.
Yeah.
Fuck the haters. I said that.
Oh, you know the other big romantic comedy, I should mention this, that comes out this year, though, that Netflix does produce and actually makes a ton of waves, is Always Be My Maybe, which is a pretty important film in terms of, like Asian romantic comedy
representation.
Yeah, like, there's a lot going on in that movie. And Netflix does get to do that. But, you know, they know that in order to make a movie like that, they've also got to, you know, make a movie like Murder Mystery. It's that trade-off of filmmaking where you need the moneymaker so that you can kind of push the envelope.
Yeah, it's the Faustian bargain that Netflix constantly creates with mm-hmm. every film that they make. Like, if you look at it, this is an interesting thing and something that we can explore on something like The Say Report someday. For every murder mystery, you have something that's pushing the envelope a little bit, like Always Be My Maybe.
Variety even takes the moment to talk about Always Be My Maybe as one of the top 10 films of 2019 for them, and the very last line is infinitely better than Murder Mystery.
Two completely different types of films.
Oh man, why bring it up?
Because it's sponsored content by Netflix in Variety, and we're now saying the quiet part out loud. And that's the way the news goes. So you ready to get to the synopsis of this film before we continue a little bit deeper down the road? Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston play Nick and Audrey Spitz. Nick is a sergeant in the NYPD who identifies as a detective. Audrey is a hairdresser and murder novel hobbyist, and both are beginning to feel more than a little bit of strain on their relationship. Their frustrations are primarily represented by a postcard of Europe that Nick gave Audrey on their wedding day, marked "Soon, Love Nick." In lieu of a honeymoon, as time has marched on and their busy, busy lives have kept this long unfulfilled, it has bubbled up inside of Audrey until finally she says something on the eve of their 15th wedding anniversary. Feeling trapped and taking a page from the last role Adam played against Jennifer, he decides to just go with it and tell her that her gift from him is that he will finally make good on his word and take her on their delayed honeymoon to Europe. On the flight over, in an effort to avoid paying $9 for earplugs, Audrey sneaks into first class, where she meets Charles Cavendish, nephew of Malcolm Quince, a man worth $70 billion, on his way to celebrate his uncle's nuptials to Cavendish's ex-fiancee, Susie Nakamura. Charles' original plan was to get blind drunk and ruin the festivities, but after meeting Audrey and hearing her plight, he decides that inviting his new American friends might just mitigate his own social masochism. Despite having booked a bus tour to see how the ham is cured, the Spitzes realize it would be insane to to pass up a trip via yacht to the Grand Prix in Monaco and take Charles up on his extremely generous offer. Once on board the Mediterranean Queen, we meet the rest of the guests on the trip. Malcolm's son Tobias, Nick's favorite actress, Grace Ballard, Colonel Charles Ulenga of the Namibian Defense Force and his bodyguard, former Spetsnaz Sergei Radjenko, Maharaja Vikram Shivan Govindan of Mumbai, and Formula One driver Juan Carlo Rivera. That evening, Malcolm addresses the family, sharing he has decided to cut everyone off, seeing them as repugnant leeches, blood fat from suckling on the teat of his good work. Additionally, he has amended his will, leaving his entire fortune to his new bride. However, before he can sign the papers, the lights go out, and when they come back on, Malcolm lies dead with the legendary Fairly heirloom, the Quince Dagger, lodged in his heart. As a police officer, Nick takes control of the crime scene and a plate of shrimp, telling Captain Wong to lock it off and the guests to retire to their yacht rooms until they dock in Monaco. Unfortunately, Toby types up a confession and takes his own life before they arrive. This clean-cut explanation doesn't air well with Interpol Inspector Laurent Delacroix, whose prime suspects are the two strangers at the party. Now the Spitzes must solve this murder mystery or risk going to jail for a crime they're pretty sure they didn't commit.
Pretty sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the things that strikes me as you read through that is, as I'm thinking about this movie, I think part of the reason that I like it so much, like, despite its, you know, its middle of the roadness, is that for a murder mystery, there's not much malice in it. Like,
that's a good point.
You know what I mean? Like there's not, it's not like watching, like, just to keep referring to it, it's not like watching Billy Madison where, like, everyone around him is fed up with his shit, right? Like, there are people in this world that like the Spitz, including Cavendish, right? Like, he actually seems to very much just enjoy Audrey's company and then, like, invites her on this, and, like, he just enjoys having them around. He never at any point is rude or mean to either of them. Even when Nick says some, you know, like, you know, macho man shit to him, both of them say it like in both of them treat each other with respect, you know. You know, it's not to say that there is not any malice in this. Like, there's that moment when they first meet Toby where things are a little squishy, where he, you know, he eyeballs them, or, you know, there's a couple of moments with other characters, like when he first meets the Colonel and he tries to throw them off the boat, right? Like, there's those moments where these things happen, and so they definitely are not welcome in this environment, but there's never really a moment where you feel like they are, like, they're not buffoons in this environment. You know what I mean? Like, they're not upsettingly in the way at any point.
Which is
you know, actually kind of the opposite. The fact that they get to be the fly on the wall for a lot of interesting conversations is the only way that this movie works.
Yeah, it is the part of this film that works for me, because there is parts of this film that just flat do not work for me. But that's, I think that's more reserved for later on in the discussion of this particular piece.
I mean, I think we're there, man. Like there's plenty to say about this movie that I do enjoy, but I am very interested to know what parts don't quite work for you, because I don't know if there's any part of this movie that I outright think go ahead. What are some things in this movie that don't work?
So really, the one thing in this film, it's one thing that doesn't work for me, and that is that their relationship is strained in any way.
Yeah.
It is the hardest thing to believe. It almost feels like I've switched to another channel for certain conversations, and then I switch back to this film, and it just so happens that Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston are married in both movies.
It's what I hinted at earlier, is there's that trope with this kind of romantic story where they are already together, where they have to at some point have, you know, because all romantic movies, comedies or otherwise dramas, have to have that moment where the question is put on the table, like, why are we doing this? And then, you know, it's the movie's responsibility to remind you why. The thing is that there's so many good moments between the two of them throughout the beginning and throughout this movie, that when it finally comes, when that moment comes, when they really have to push apart and go separate ways for all of 10 minutes, it just doesn't make sense. And in a lot of ways, it's really like, it's really all the part that really doesn't make sense for me is Audrey, like, because Nick doesn't leave her side. He does follow her up until the moment when he splits off to follow Susie. And that's just because he's trying to do what he knows Audrey wanted him to do all along. And that was solve this thing. So, like, yeah,
I will interject there. He waits to make sure that that Audrey is safe.
Safe.
That's true. He waits to make sure that she is out of town. He sees Cavendish take her to Lake Cuomo via the back roads which is one of my favorite lyrics in any movie ever. Like, such a great line of Lake Cuomo via the back roads. Like, are there back roads to Lake Cuomo that I'm just not aware of?
I feel like there's probably just a couple of roads and they're all through the countryside. But anyway.
Yeah. It's just, it's a funny line. But as soon as he sees that she is safe, right? That is when he kicks into trying to solve it again. And that, like, represents another thing of just how devoted he is to his wife in this film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they have to push some stuff with him, even from the beginning. The idea that he, you know, he lies to her about being a detective. The idea that he is really shitty about, like, money and stuff like that. Like, they do introduce flaws for him and their relationship, but there's never a moment where those flaws are not acknowledged. Like, they talk to each other about all of that stuff, besides the lying. But even the lying is brought to the forefront by the very first conversation in the film with his friend and his friend's wife. Like, there's – so, like, that's – it is always acknowledged and is always addressed. It is always important when it occurs. It doesn't just happen for the sake of comedy. It doesn't just happen for the sake of like, oh, you know, women, bleh. Like, that's just not – like, the worst moments of that for me are actually front and center when there's like this entire like round robin stand-up bit going in the hairdressing salon.
Yeah, that made me question if this is Jennifer Aniston's movie. Is this a Jennifer Aniston film and Adam Sandler is just the prop? Which would be fine, right? It's something that we're going to find out as we go deeper into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And seeing if there are connections and through lines, there are going to be movies where Adam Sandler is there and is not the front and center funny guy.
Right.
And it really, especially on the heels, and I'm sorry about referencing it, but that's kind of the point of Adam and looking at these two films with each other. On the heels of Just Go With It, where she is so much a prop for such a long time in that movie until they decide, oh, we're going to give you this storyline with Nicole Kidman.
Right.
And then even then, like, it's not, she's not much more developed than that. They just give her stakes. Really?
Yeah, they give her stakes, but they give her upsetting, problematic ones, and that she's just a shitty sorority girl, besides also being a background character to Adam Sandler's movie. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So I almost expected, and a lot of this movie, it kind of is that, because he's such just a devoted husband to her, and she's also weirdly devoted to him, but I think in terms of the devotion, like, she wishes that the devotion from Nick Spitz was more romantic, as opposed to he always makes sure that I'm fed and clothed and, like, loved. But it would be nice if he would, you know, wipe off his desk and take me right there in the study once in a while.
Right. So she allows her grievances to be known, but at no point do you ever feel like it's going to be enough where she's going to consider it worthy of leaving him, right? Like, even when sexy ass Luke Evans shows up on the plane talking all like smooth to her, and then he says, I have a yacht and I'm the nephew of a billionaire, all of this, there's never a moment where you think, oh, she's gonna get, like, she's gonna cheat on me, like, you know, essentially, like,
Dracula about to be told by Jennifer Aniston.
Dracula treating on one Dracula for another. I can't believe it. But the idea that, like, that she's that's not the story, right? Like, and you know, the absence of that should not be like a thing to celebrate, but unfortunately it kind of is. Like, in any other hands, that could very easily have been the story here, is that Nick Spitz has to defend his honor with his wife against this guy that he knows is the killer. But that's not the story at all in this one.
No, it's so good. That scene where she meets Charles Cavendish in the bar on a plane, which is just as surprising to me, that, like, here's a full-on bar in the middle of this plane, right? and also, in addressing the Just Go With It of it all, right? Good on Adam Sandler in his two appearances with Jennifer Aniston being a person who can lie about going on a trip and then being able to immediately book and afford that airfare.
Yeah.
Like, he did that. I'm like, we're going to Europe. He had no planning on this. This literally just happened.
Might be a sign of Sandler being a little out of touch with the common man.
There's a good point there. And maybe that's why I'm feeling like definitely not an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe piece. Yeah, still a good Adam Sandler cinema film, but...
But while I've, you know, I've blown the door off on that one, like, let's talk about that. One of the things that I really enjoyed in this one is he was much more of an everyman. He was much more of a down-to-earth, blue-collar guy that was trying to do good, but was a little faulted in certain areas. Much more of the Sandler guy that I love from our universe that we established. Not enough that I would that I say that alone merits it being one of the heroes, but you know, he fits in much better with a Hubie and with a Nikki than Danny ever did.
Yeah, well, Danny McAbee might be the worst Adam. He's the Adam Sandler character that's in the league of Adam Sandler villains.
All right, I don't want to get too much further because I feel like we're going to start touching on the limited amount of material we had for our other usual segment.
Yes, which is something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue. Was about to segue in as you talked about us seeing a familiar blue collar Adam Sandler again. Thanks for picking up on the cues, big guy. I'd like to go first with my new, because if you take my new, I don't have a backup. I have a backup for the other three. I don't have a backup for new.
My news got a caveat we got to talk about anyway, so go nuts.
Okay. My new is, this is a married Adam Sandler character. This is the first film that we've watched in this experiment where he is married and still in the relationship.
Yeah. He has a healthy established marriage that remains healthy and established throughout the entire film. Even in their lowest moments, they're never not bad. Yeah, no, yeah. That's great.
And it's a completely different way to look at a character who we started out with as a 26-year-old fucking fuck up.
Yeah, it's wild. Yeah, it kind of gets into like the older, more mature Sandler that we touched on a little bit with the idea of him and there being kids that involved and stuff like that, right? But we are seeing in these last couple of movies, and I'm sure in more that to come, that the turn from Sandler as being the man child to having to grow up, right?
Yeah,
is going to be an interesting one to talk about a little bit more. Yeah, definitely.
What do you got, big guy?
Well, so the thing for me that really struck me is this is the first time that we have seen a Sandler film, by all accounts, Sandler led to, like, this is definitely one of the projects that him and Happy Madison Productions really got behind creating, mm-hmm. that is so heavily satirical. And the reason that I put a caveat on that is because you could look at something like Hubie Halloween and say that it drew on a lot of stuff from scary movies, but it not as much as this. Like, every piece of this movie is pulling on a mystery story of some kind, right? Like, I mean, the introduction of all of the characters, the slow motion shot of all of them leaving the dining room after the murder, it felt like it was straight out of Kenneth Branagh's Murder on the Orient Express, which may or may not have come out at this point, but if you told me that it had and they stole it from that, I believe you, right? Like,
yeah.
But you know, everything from there being the billionaire that gets murdered for the will, there's the writer's son that's misunderstood, there's the actress that is semi-related to the family that has a mysterious connection to everything. You know, you've got the Maharaja, you've got the colonel from a foreign country that owes a life debt, right? Like, all of this stuff is straight out of just... Agatha Christie's the easy one to pull from, but all of these mysteries.
It's basically Cluedo. I just use Clue as my... Yeah. I'm like, yeah, it's Clue. The colonel? Colonel Mustard made sure there was a colonel in every mystery going forward in Ad Finitum.
Yeah. But, you know, you have the mysterious Russian security guard that doesn't speak. That is it feels like it's straight out of like a Bond mystery, right? Like, there's all of these little elements that he pulls from moment one to the end. Even to the silliest fucking thing that I think is in the movie. The one thing that I think really stands out as enjoyable but just doesn't work in is the car chase at the end of this movie. It comes out of nowhere. It is, the mystery is already solved, and yeah, you want to throw another twist on it because that's what these movies always do, right? Is they solve the mystery, but then there's a larger twist. Like, I'm down for that too. It is the idea that the cop has him. He is arrested. They chase. They realize it and they arrest the guy, And then he somehow gets away, jumps in a car, and there's a 10-minute car chase at the end of this movie. Just because Adam Sandler wanted to be in a car chase. And there's a lot of really great moments about Jennifer Aniston being the one driving in the car chase.
Yeah, that's
really
the final
enjoyed.
Twist for me, is that the steering wheel is on the passenger
yeah.
side.
Yeah, yeah,
because
yeah, yeah.
there's no reason that the steering wheel of a Ferrari, an Italian-made car, would not be on the left side.
Especially in Italy.
Especially in Italy! Like,
if you were in the United States, I might forgive you because maybe somebody modded it for themselves. But no, you're in Italy in a Ferrari. Guess what's not going to happen?
That exact thing! And I'm just like, yeah. what a twist. And and then the fact that she's a kick-ass driver who can take yeah. down an F1 guy is... It works. It really works. But that moment where, like, oh, the steering wheel's over here, I'm like, it wouldn't be. Right?
Oh man, yeah, no, I like I said, like it's fun. It's really fun, and it feels like, you know, oh, it's extra twist on top of extra twist, and it turns into the French Connection. Like I love all of that. It's just it is unnecessary. Like that is the point of this movie where you start to call it, all right, this is the masturbatory Sandler I came here for. Like,
and I get it. I don't disagree.
Like, so. Back to my rule, right? Like, this is the first time that we're seeing Sandler not just do homages to old films, but straight up doing satire of these older films and doing his own fun. Like, wouldn't it be funny if in the middle of all of this, an old Jewish couple were there? That's yeah. the joke every step of the way.
Like, and that would just, I'm surprised there's not just an old Jewish couple on the boat played by Adam Sandler's parents. And then they're just, they went to bed. Where are the Epsteins? Well, the Epsteins are in bed. So that,
it's just in the meeting, everybody.
But I think the fact that the Epsteins aren't there, right, and I wish I'd picked a better name, is it really speaks to the fact that this is more satire than parody. And that's already a delicate line to be dancing with. But this is not Meet the Spartans. In
right.
terms of
right.
the jokes that it is making about existing media. This is something that has a deep love for that media and then is saying, but it's kind of absurd, right? Like, there's inherent absurdity in the stuff that we just accept in these films.
I love the conversation when they're in bed and she's like, who do you think did it? And he's like, I know who did it. It's the sun. And she's like, no, that's too obvious. It's never the obvious one. And he's like, are you kidding me? It's always the obvious one. Like, that conversation is just perfect because he's like, as a cop, believe me, it's always the obvious one.
It's also hyper meta because yeah. every time we watch a murder mystery, right, we're watching it. It is created. It is media. It's not real, right? It's usually fiction. Even if it's based on real events, things have been fictionalized, right, about it. So we always look at that as, well, he's the obvious choice, so it's probably a misdirection. But you also need to look at Nick and Audrey as people who are really living through this. So,
yeah.
No, the obvious one is the one that it probably is.
Right.
Like... No. He's not like, I'm going to make myself look guilty. And maybe it'll make the real killer slip up. No.
That even speaks to that super sexy Luke Evans line on the plane. When she's like, with a name like that, you'd be the bad guy. And he's like, well, then here's to the bad guys. And like takes that drink of the scotch. Like, it's just like, oh, damn, my. Like that moment, though, is like pure satire, right? Like,
yeah.
Because it is like he's quoting a movie that's never been made.
Exactly. It's great. And it is. It's wonderful. The film is very aware of what it is doing. And that's why it's satire. It's not just, oh, wouldn't this be funny? And then this would be funny. And there's no way to connect those two things. Yeah. Yeah,
and that is maybe where the line gets drawn with something like Hubie, is that so much of the jokes in Hubie are parody. They are a parody of old monster movies, of old murder movies, of old Hitchcock movies, like to the point where, and this is maybe to your point about this not fitting into the universe, magic exists in Hubie.
Right.
Full stop. I do not believe this is a universe in which magic would exist.
Unless when that dagger were taken out of his chest, he magically sprung to life.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. All right, so let's go old, and I'll let you take the reins on this one.
I just want to give a big old welcome back to Jennifer Aniston. We talked last time about how they have been old friends for a long time, and this is, she is not new to the Sandler verse at this point. And it was good to see the two of them get to do a movie like this after knowing their relationship and seeing what Just Go With It was. It was a bit of a bummer, shall I say, that they didn't get to do their project together and have it just be them just having a good old time, whereas that's what this movie was. And so, like, that just felt good. Like, we kind of already touched on a lot of, like, the ways in which the two of them together are just work so well. The little moments, the little conversations between them that are clearly, like, improv is the word, but that implies that, like, there was nothing in the script. Clearly there was just, like, a squabble written in the script, but the two of them just have fun with it. But, like, him just like pointing at the shrimp bowl, right, and they take it and all that, and then the moment right after with the two of them enjoying it together as they sit there, or the Clarendon Allegra part, like that moment is just so good. And when he says the line, like, you know what Allegra is in French is the same shit as Clarendon, and then they show Jennifer Aniston and she has a genuine laugh in that moment.
Like, you see why they're together, and it doesn't make sense that, like, these petty squabbles are enough for, like, I'm supposed to feel like their marriage is on its last legs, and I never do. I never do, film.
No, I don't ever feel that way, ever. What you got?
Well, usually I would say I have two things. Which one do you want to hear first? But whichever door you went through, I would lead with Black Man Would Hand.
Oh, man. I didn't even put that together. Like, oh, man.
To the fact that his hand comes off, Colonel Uluganda's hand comes off the same exact way that Chubbs Peterson's hand comes off. Wow. Like, it is, they clearly got their hands from the same, like, wooden prostheticist built their prosthesis. I actually wouldn't be surprised to find out that it was a set and Chubbs got the right hand and the Colonel got the left hand. It's one of those moments where, like, Black Man Would Hand, and it made me so happy. But it's one of those things that also sort of supported, even though there is this small, very obvious Adam Sandler, like, reference here, that it's not meant to be anything more than a reference, where Chubbs Peterson literally showing up in Little Nicky means that Happy Gilmore exists in this universe.
I mean, you can see the thought process, right? Where they're like, we were creating this Colonel character that is this very stock character in Mysteries. These are the elements that are usually there, prosthetic of some kind, wooden leg. And then somebody goes, well, obviously it has to be a wooden hand, right? Like, somebody in the room says that, and everybody's like, all right, there you go, there's the reference. Like,
is Carl Weathers available to play the role? Right. Oh, no, he's doing The Mandalorian. Let's get to T'Challa's dad.
Yeah, let's get to Black Panther then. Let's do it. All right.
So that's it. And the other one that I had just as a backup, and I will share it, is goats. Whenever I see a goat in an Adam Sandler thing, I fuck me into Gota. I just think about the goat tied up in his little talking goat, and it's there every time I see a goat in an Adam Sandler film. So I'm more Black Man Would Hand, but the goat also needs to get just the tip of the hat. Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Going into Borrowed, you can go first again on this one.
I mean, here's the thing, and this really kind of does speak to the idea that this doesn't quite work for the universe, is that this movie wears so much of itself on its sleeve. So, like, the Borrowed for this is so clearly all of the mystery stuff we've already talked about, right? Like, there's not like a deeper thing that I can really point to here. Like, I make it a point in these Borrowed sections to talk about, like, Sandler's love of film and how that is what is present and on display in these moments. But Sandler's love of old mystery films, like Hitchcockian films, that whole moment when they're going across the ledge out the window after the Russian spy gets killed felt straight like out of The Man Who Knew Too Much and things like that, right? Like, I could think of just these very specific movies that I'm sure Sandler watched because of his love of film. So, I mean, it's the mystery. Like, that's the that is the Borrow for this movie.
I have two words for you. Die Hard.
Oh.
This movie is so fucking Die Hard. And I want to give all the credit to Adam Sandler, but the other big thing about this is that this is directed by Kyle Nowacek. Kyle Nowacek is the fourth workaholic. We see Anders Holm, we see Blake, and we see Andy Devine. Is that his name?
Adam Devine.
Adam Devine, yeah. And Adam Devine, those are the guys who are on screen playing the roles. Kyle is the guy
has a walk-on in this movie. I say that's not even the right phrase. On the plane, when Jennifer Aniston goes into first class, somebody is watching.
Game Over Man. Yeah, exactly. Right. And Game Over Man is very much a parody of Die Hard. Like, it is very much borrowing from Die Hard. So then, obviously, Kyle Newacek and the Workaholics guys, who have a deal with Netflix as well as Adam Sandler, like, that's why they're coming together. And I almost wonder, is it because Kyle Newacek is directing this that there are these weird moments that feel so Die Hard to me? Or is it just Die Hard is something that it's a cop who's on vacation and we kind of want to lean into the inherent Die Hardness of it that's present?
You know what I really like about that, too, is it shows the ability by Sandler and his people to be able to do something like that and have it not turn into Paul Blart.
Yeah, right. I mean, because Paul Blart also Die Hard.
But it is the difference between parody and satire. Yeah. Like, this is a movie that loved Die Hard and loves the idea of the good old boy cop in the bad situation, right? Like that is definitely the very Die Hard, like, heart of Die Hard. Whereas, like, Paul Blart is just a bunch of references to a guy that can't fit in a fucking air vent, right? Like, that's right.
That's such a good scene, though. Paul Blart's a good movie. We're going to talk about it someday.
That's a word that was just said here. Anyway, we will talk about that off mic. We will have some words.
Oh, no, I'm in trouble. But no, it's Die Hard. And the moment where I, like, really, I immediately knew that this was being directed by Kyle Newacek as soon as Montez from Workaholics was his friend cop. Because I'm like, oh, so Kyle Newacek is directing this film. And then, like, so all these moments where it, like, felt like a Kyle Newacek film, I was completely fine with. But then it's after he gets the two burner cell phones and he calls his partner, and it is literally lifted from when John McClane calls Al in the airport in Die Hard 2. And he's like, I need you to get some information from me. and Al's like, what is going on? I'm hearing all this crazy stuff about you and the airport and in Washington. And he's like, it's not important. This is what I need you to do. And he's like, I got you. And I'm just like, oh my God, it's Die Hard. Like, yeah. This movie is just Die Hard. But awesome. Like, the thinnest thread of it, it made me really happy.
Yeah, that's wild. Like, that is such a good pull. Yeah, just because, you know, that's what I mean. Is like, there's so much in his movies. I cannot believe it's something I never really thought about when I was, like, growing up watching his movies, because it just seems so obvious to me now how much his movies really are movies made by somebody who just loves the movies. And it's not like Quentin Tarantino, who's like, I'm gonna make movies for Hollywood to come and see. Like, fuck that. Like, that's definitely not what Sandler's doing. He's making movies for the little Adam Sandler out there watching movies. Like, that's what he's thinking of.
Yeah, you're not wrong. It worked, and it did. It made me, it helped me connect with the film a little bit more, where I'm like, it's Die Hard.
I love Die Hard. We've already kind of blown the top off of my blue. I mean, like, the blue for me, the bluest the comedy gets in this movie really does come down to the tropes of the old Wilma Flintstone tropes. The beautiful woman with the dopey man, why is she with him? Questions that this movie dares to ask when we see why they're together so often. So, like, it's not even like it's done well, but it is there. Like, that's where some of the most boring comedy comes from for me. I will say, though, it's interesting that this is really kind of the first time I can't really point to anything that outright, like, offended me. You know, there's, like, maybe a joke or two made at the expense of David Williams' character for being flamboyant and
a screaming queen. That's what I was. I kind of thought that's where you were going to go with it, because.
But the reason I don't is because David Williams always plays the character that takes that kind of criticism. You know what I mean? Like that is just kind of what he does. So in a weird way, like, I guess that doesn't forgive it. It's just weird to me. Like, it just didn't surprise me, I guess is what I'll say.
I mean, it speaks to the whole satire design that you've placed down for this film, in terms of the fact that he doesn't ever present as that in this film. We're only told that that's who this character is.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and it's never brought up again. That's the other thing about it, I think, that really got me, is like a lot of the times when we talk about these blue jokes in these Sandler films, is there ones that go on too long or come back later and unwanted and unexpected? And that is one line said by the drunk asshole-ish nephew who's there just to piss everybody
off.
He's
only there to stir shit. Like, that's right, why, right. I'm coming.
So, it's one line said by one character that we're not really meant to take too seriously anyway, and it never comes up again. So, yes, it's an offensive line, but if that's the most that I can pull from this movie is one offensive line out of the entire film, that's a huge step up from a lot of the other Sandler films we've watched.
I mean, it's literally what I wrote down is what I thought you were going to complain about. Highlight as, bluer comedy in the film.
So the thing that comes back constantly that is kind of more upsetting is the stupid jokes about, men don't understand women and women don't understand men. And, old married couples have these fights and sometimes they say things that they don't mean. Like, that kind of humor is just, it's not blue so much as it is just easy.
Yeah. And it's an unfortunate, it's almost part of the vocabulary of this type of film. It almost goes unnoticed. But you're not wrong. I mean, that whole sequence in the hair salon, it feels so out of place when you consider everything else that's going on in this. And also, a more blue joke like the Vikram's premature ejaculation. not only is... That's one of the best moments for Adam and Jennifer, sitting under the bed, literally just laughing.
Yeah.
I can't believe that we're under this bed, that we're two multimillionaires making a movie.
She does not belittle him in that moment. No. She is clearly disappointed and leaves, but she does not take the moment to insult him. She does not berate him. It is not something that is brought up in any more joking way other than a slight reference at the end where he is literally given advice by Sandler's character. So it's not a joke at his expense.
It's more we've all been there, buddy. Try this. Instead of just being grab the bottom.
So even that kind of gets weirdly, I lose track of that one because of the way that it's just not a constant in this movie, you know?
Yeah. And that really speaks to the intelligence that's on display, compared against some of the other stuff that we've seen Sandler do, earlier in his career. And all of this talking is going to make my blue, it's going to be a swing and a miss. It's going to be as forgettable as Maurice the cook, who we never get to meet, and that breaks my heart. My blue is Claritin. I've never really thought of Claritin being the one in the blue box.
Blue box, but it's important because at the end,
the Japanese Claritin.
Even though it's in Japanese, we recognize that that's Claritin, and that's when we realize, it's actually super important to the plot.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Dad.
What congratulations?
Yeah, no, you finally found a blue thing that was probably worth more talking more about than my blue thing. I'm just saying.
I mean, let's talk about the beginning where Allegra is 50 cents less.
Oh,
and he's
God.
Like, I'm going to buy the Allegra. It's also, the other great thing about that is there's less in the Allegra than in the Claritin. Yeah, he doesn't do that thing. I just had to buy magnesium for my father. Mm-hmm. And I bought, and I did the math to get him the best one. And then he's like, this isn't what I usually get. And I'm like, yeah, but here's why. And he's like, oh, good. And it's like, Adam Sandler's character, it adds that level of, not like just insensitivity where he's only looking at the bottom line. It's big for his character that he's very right brained while his wife is left brained.
Yeah. No, it is a huge part for his character that he was concerned more about saving the money than he was about the fact that he was not getting as much product for the money. Yeah. Right. I do also, this is a good way for us to talk about that moment. I love that whole scene for the reason in which it establishes all of this stuff about his character. It is such a good establishing scene for him. Because after learning some of the crappier stuff about him, like lying to his wife and not getting into the detective stuff and things like that, they needed to have a scene that made him a little bit more relatable. And him finding the goofy-ass card, him settling on the Amazon gift card and the Claritin and all that really shows you like that side of his character. And then you instantly get to see this other side of his character where he catches the kid robbing the store and he lets him go. And like, you know, he makes a comment about how it's because he's late for dinner, but like at the end of the day, like he's a cop, right? And he just watched this kid rob this place. Like if he had to tell them like I'm late because I caught a kid like thrift shopping, like go, you know.
Rob this place is a little. He was shoplifting. And actually, what I dig about that, right, is it simultaneously tells us he would be a good detective if he didn't get the yips during the test that he has failed
Yes.
3 times. But then, even by his own admission, wow, I can't believe I was right.
No, he's really good at what he does, and he would the it establishes that idea that we now have to do with police, that he would be a good cop, right? Like he would not be the kind of cop that would ruin a kid's life for doing this thing. Like there's a very different way that a kid robbing a convenience store could go nowadays, right? But the idea that he lets the kid go, it says something about it speaks to his character.
And that's also necessary because his partner in the beginning is like, I'd hide a dead body for you. And it's like, are you guys bad cops? Are you dirty cops? How many bodies have you hidden, Montez?
Well, so what it really is, like to really, you know, pull the rug off of this thing, like it is the save the cat moment, right? Like it is that thing that you need for your hero to show that he's a good guy, is when he lets that kid get away with it, is his save the cat moment. And you know, so that kind of gets back to a lot of the criticism of this film, right? Is like kind of the mediocreness of it all. Is like that's a really good moment for his character. But in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't do much. Like in terms of moving action along, right? Like it's not fun, right? Right. So it becomes kind of just meh because he doesn't do something about the fact that he watched a kid rob a store. It shows that his character is kind of meh, and so like it's an interesting thing where he tries to make this really lovable like guy, this really relatable character, and like these two really relatable characters in both of the Spitzes, right? And the fact that like the joke is what if these two relatable characters were in this crazy unrelatable situation is like the bit, but it just leads to just a film that is just like okay, it's okay.
And that's, I guess, yeah, it doesn't move any mountains. It's mediocre because it comes and it does its job. And it actually really speaks to a thought process in America, that just showing up and doing your job isn't enough anymore. You have to excel, you have to have a level of excellence. And that's just not true in everything.
Well, so I wonder
Sometimes.
if that's. Sorry, go ahead, finish
No,
your
no,
thought.
no. Sometimes that's enough, right?
I just wonder if maybe that's one of the really kind of big things that we can learn from Sandler choosing to move to Netflix for this last part of his last part. That was not the right words to use. This later part of his career, where he chooses to go to a place where he no longer has to play the weird Hollywood game, because you know, the 90s, it wasn't about making the most money. It was about making the biggest splash, because then money could be made with merchandise. Money could be made with TV rights and HBO and all that. The money will come as long as you can make the splash, right? And he was really good at making a splash, and he still is really good at making a splash. It's just that what movie companies started to do is they started to change the ways in which they considered a movie a success. And suddenly, the movies he wanted to make weren't the movies that were quote unquote successful anymore, even though they were making plenty of money, even though they were going to do great on TBS and USA later on, and they were going to do great on DVD sales and like and movie rental services and things like that. Like he wasn't bringing in that first weekend profit that we now know is like the only way that movie companies, at least before COVID, were measuring success. And so he moved to a platform where that shit didn't matter. Netflix, it doesn't matter so much to Netflix that they hide their numbers. They don't tell anybody how well anything's doing. The fact that I even have that 30 million number to go off of, and that's only cited from a bunch of different reviews. It's not like I actually read Netflix saying this is what they watched it, right?
And
So
Mr.
like even
Netflix
that's
didn't come out and
right.
announce.
Yeah. So like he literally moved himself to a platform where the numbers don't matter. He can just continue to do what he does as long as he is quote unquote successful in his own right, and like, and as long as Netflix and him can agree that that is an okay way to be successful, and like, more power to him for that, right? And Netflix is definitely catching a lot of heat lately for having a lot of stuff that appeals to either too large of an audience to the point where nobody can really call themselves a fan, or too niche of an audience that, like, everybody's just like, well, why would they do that? Only like 3 people are going to watch it. Yeah, but those 3 people are probably then also going to buy the toys and the magazines and all of this shit. Like, Netflix isn't stupid. Like, they know when it's worth doing a niche hit versus doing a major hit. And sometimes they're very happy to just have a mediocre subpar comedy come out for the month of April or whatever, and that be their beginning of the summer comedy that people watch until their Oscar baity The Irishman comes out at the end of the year.
You wrapped that up in a beautiful bow, Sijin. All power to the reactor, my friend. I mean, yeah, it's... But what this film also does for me, what watching Murder Mystery does for me, because I am going to live in my decision that this is not part of the shared cinematic universe that we established with the first 6 films. As much as I would actually kind of want it to be, I don't believe magic exists in this world, which is something that you've already cited. I don't think that there is a heaven or a hell, just based on the way that these characters act and react. You know, maybe one of these people, like the colonel, was like highly religious, or if the Maharaja had some sort of religion there, like religion doesn't play a part in it. And it's not that Adam Sandler's out there doing these hyper religious movies, right? It's just you can kind of tell in those films that he was making in the beginning that his own ideals and ideas about religion that he was taught is something that he was coming to terms with as he was growing up, so it makes its way into those films.
Well, and as a culture, people were much more openly in a camp, I shall say, right? like we live in a world now where there are a lot more people willing to admit that they're not religious, they don't practice religion, and more than that, willing to just not go to church on Sunday, right? Like if I was my age now in 1995, I would probably still be going to church on Sunday. Not because I personally would be having any stronger beliefs about the absence of or presence of a God, but just because that's what everybody my age at that point in 1995 was doing on a Sunday, right? Like you'd that was just part of the American culture. You were attending a house of worship at some point in your life for a lot of people. Not as much anymore. And so I feel like it's not so much that religion was a bigger part for him of his life when he was younger, so much as it was a part of everybody's life when he was younger. So I don't think he was any more so or any less religious than the rest of the world has kind of always been, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. But then I understand why after this film, Adam Sandler doing a film like Hubie Halloween is the one that gets people saying, oh my God, is there a shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films? And it's not just because Ben Stiller is there as Hal from Happy Gilmore. It is because after this movie, right? After Murder Mystery, which is so in its own world, you go back to a movie that very clearly exists in that same universe as something like Happy Gilmore.
Well, and let's not forget some of the other Netflix movies he's made, like Sandy Wexler or the
Cobbler.
That was a Netflix one?
That was his first one.
I'm thinking of the one that I'm thinking of is the one where he's actually part of like the 6 or 7 person ensemble.
Ridiculous Six?
With Dustin Hoffman and stuff.
Oh no.
The serious ones. the Jewish Stories one with Ben Stiller and stuff. Hold on, I'm literally looking at his IMDb. Why am I guessing?
That's fun. I have it in front of me, but I want to try on my own to get there. No, it's fine.
The Meyerowitz Stories. Thank you. Yeah, those are the kinds of movies that he's doing around Murder Mystery, right? Is like, these are not movies that are going to fit into that universe at all. You know, again, this one out of all of those is probably going to be the closest, and as we're pointing out here, it doesn't fit either, right? So like, when something like Hubie Halloween comes out, it is a return to form for him in terms of the universe stuff. I won't say that in terms of like good comedy or good filmmaking or anything like that, because I feel like a lot of these movies we mentioned have actually been some of his better films, but like, you know, this is I mean, sorry, Hubie is really the him getting back to his roots in a lot of ways.
And this is outside of that realm. Because, I mean, one of the big tenets that we've talked about existing in that Adam Sandler cinematic universe is family. Like, family is an important thing. And it almost feels like Adam Sandler is almost satirizing his own idea of what an Adam Sandler movie is. Because Terrence Stamp, as Malcolm Quince, talks so much about family. And the Colonel is like, this trip is family only. And, like, so Adam Sandler is aware that, like, that familial relationship, that fact that you build your own family and you're there for each other. And then this is sort of the other side of that coin, right? Mm-hmm. That some people manipulate that term family to just fit their own narrative, be it for profit or notoriety or just to ride on a yacht every so often in Europe. It's really interesting, but it doesn't give you that the warm fuzzies.
No, it's the anti-family, right? Like
Which in a lot of weird ways is also something that you kind of see in Just Go With It before. No, we really do care about each other. This isn't just a job, right? We're going to teach the kid to swim.
Well, Just Go With It. Feels like he is fighting tooth and nail every step of the way to make it a Sandler film.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. This one, it never feels like he's trying to force this into any type of Sandler verse. Yeah. Right? Like, this feels like, again, like they're just having a good time just making this movie. And that is what I think, and I think that is part of why that makes this one much more enjoyable to me, is because, again, I like watching people just have fun making films. Even if the film doesn't turn out great, I will watch a bunch of people having a good time a million times over. I mean, see our latest episode of the Say Report on the Suicide Squad, right? To me, I am much more into the latest one because it just feels like everybody was happy to be there. Whereas, like, when David Ayer made his, there was a lot of people that felt like they were maybe contractually obligated to show up. That kind of stuff. Like, there's a sense in Murder Mystery that he doesn't care that it doesn't fit into the rest of his oeuvre. This is him doing something that he just wants to do for the moment.
Right. And in fact, I think the fact that it might not fit in with the rest of his oeuvre is an important part about this film. Is the fact that, like, because I'm not trying to make Billy Madison 2, though once everybody's cut off from the family, I expected 8 people to go back to first grade. I almost thought that's what this movie was going to be. It's one of those situations where, like, I'm not trying to do that. Really, what I'm trying to do is satirize the mystery genre. And it also makes sense when you see things like Serial as a huge podcast and this obsession that we had with murder and mystery in the grander scheme of the world, right? Like, it makes sense that he's like, now's the time where I can finally do this weird thing I've always kind of wanted to do. And on top of that, I mean, I think he calls up Jennifer Aniston and he's like, hey, do you want to do what we tried to do at Just Go With It? But with this, like, and I would be surprised to find out that she didn't have some creative control with how this went. Like, she was involved in the conversation.
Very famously, there are vacation movies for people. The easiest one for me to compare this one to is The Tourist with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie, right? Where very famously the two of them wanted to take Paul Bettany out for a walk in Paris, right? Like, that is the, like that's the, that is the feel of that movie through and through. It is a nonsense film. I've never loved a movie as much as I love hate the Tourist. It is a fucking wild ride of a movie. But that is where it feels like this comes from, is they literally are just like them. And I mean, Sandler's wife is there in the film as the stewardess in the beginning. Like they're just all.
Oh, and his kids are on the tour bus, which we never talked about.
I wanted to introduce a new bit for the show with that, by the way.
Oh, okay. What's that?
It is the Devin Decker named the covert. And he shows up. He shows up for a second as the dad on the tour bus.
I know. And then he gets to really stretch his legs at the very end where he's like, I know you want to see the dead body. I'm going to take a picture of it.
Yeah, I'm going to take a picture. picture of it. Oh man, yeah, the Colbert shows up. But yeah, his kids are there. Alan Colbert is there. His wife is there. Right. So like, it's not that there's not people around that, like that one that he took on a trip with him. And on top of that, we know his relationship with Aniston. So you know that it was just like, what is a thing that we can do that can get all of us to Europe together? Like, what job can we do for four days while we're there that will pay for the other 2 months we'll spend there or whatever? You know what I mean? Like, and that is what this movie really kind of is. And that's another thing that's hard to ignore. So another reason why it probably gets a lot of heat with critics and things like that. You know, and I'm not saying that the criticism is not rightly deserved. I have admitted that it is a subpar film in a lot of ways. It's just that in a lot of ways, I don't care. like, you know what I mean?
I do.
Sometimes a movie is just a fun time to have.
I do. I mean, even down to the fact that, I mean, I watched it last night and then I watched it again today in order to be ready to do all of this. And then I'm like, oh man, this is not as good the second time. And I'm like, just shut the fuck up and enjoy it. Like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah, it's not going to be as good the second time because of the mystery, but let's focus on some of the smaller intricacies of these characters. I mean, Laurent Delacroix.
I don't know many people that could watch things on one day and then less than 12 hours later watch it a second time and find themselves really, truly enjoying it. Sorry, but you were saying.
No. I mean, Laurent Delacroix, the first time that you watch the movie, he's just the guy who blows the smoke rings, right? But there's so much love put into Davy's character.
Yeah.
Like, he builds such a beautiful, and there's the real heart. There's the real family heart. Is when they're talking about
bastards.
I love those little bastards. Like, yeah, it's just like, yeah, okay, this is an Adam Sandler film. This is definitely an Adam Sandler film. But it's a personal Adam Sandler film. Down to the fact that the only one of his crew who's there is Alan Colbert, who has to be Adam Sandler's best friend, which is a thing I never really realized until we were doing all these.
Not only that, he long his business partner because out of his crew, Colbert is the only one that's also involved in Happy Madison Studios.
Right.
Like, so in addition to, they have to have one of the greatest bromances of all time because, like, they've put up with each other through thick and thin for 30 years now. On top of that, like, they are business together. Not an easy thing to do in the world and still maintain a relationship.
Yeah. Now I feel like we're going to have a discussion after the show season. I feel like you've been hitting at a lot of things.
You are the Sandler to my Colbert.
Oh, that's so kind of you. You are more covert than me. As I sit here shirtless with a tie on because it's so hot in the studio today. Oh, man. But yeah, it's good, but I don't think it fits into anything, but I think it's okay. I think it's okay to see that these films where Adam Sandler is admittedly sharing the spotlight, where it is not just a film where it is Adam Sandler as the guy, supported by an amazing cast of characters. I think that these two Jennifer Aniston films have established, I mean, that there are pockets within the cinematic career of Adam Sandler that exist, but don't necessarily join the through line of a cinematic universe.
I think it really does two things for me. First of all, it shows us why Aniston had probably never shown up in a Sandler-verse film before, despite the fact that we've always talked about the fact that Sandler loves working with friends and family, and we know that their relationship, they've been friends for a long time. Not just because she was, you know, hitting it out of the fucking ballpark on Friends and things like that when he was at his prime and making movies, but also because she just... That is not the world of Sandler that she lives in, right? Like, it is much more on this other side of the ball, and that's, you know, that's great. Like, I mean, she makes millions of dollars making movies. I think saying that she couldn't quite find a place in the Waterboy, I think that's okay. I think she'll sleep better at night. Like, there's the other thing though that I think is really interesting that this really kind of shows me is that I think a lot of people, when they talk about Sandler, and this goes way back to even just our intro episode, not just in episode one, where we talked about the idea that there is a zeitgeist around Sandler that speaks to, you know, the ways people feel about him and his career and his films. And I think part of that zeitgeist is the feeling that he just makes a very particular type of film. Mm-hmm. And these last two movies show that, no, that's not the case. And we've kind of always known that because he does things like Punch Drunk Love, or then he goes and he does Uncut Gems, and people are like surprised. They're like, oh my god, he stepped out of his box to do this. But I think these two movies show that no, he steps out of his box a lot. It just so happens that every now and then one hits really well and people love it, and sometimes they're dramas, sometimes they're comedies, sometimes they're mysteries, sometimes they're hard. Like he is not a guy that works in one space. The thing is that is when he's his most successful, so obviously that's why we always think of him in that position. But he's done a ton of shit that is not necessarily part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, and this has been really eye-opening.
Yeah, it has, because like when everybody said if every movie is connected, like no, that can't be the case, and that's why Devin and Sijin are here, and we're going to take a look at it. But above all, what Murder Mystery taught me is why my mother, when Hubie Halloween came out, was like, we have to watch Hubie Halloween. Why it was not my choice, not my sister's choice, not even my father's choice, but my mother's choice to watch Hubie Halloween. And that is because my mother and my father saw Murder Mystery and were like, that was pretty good. It might be worth checking out his next one.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was Hubie Halloween, and I don't know. I don't think they liked it. But
lost them real quick. Well, we got a Murder Mystery 2 coming, so they should be looking forward to that.
Which I hope is on the Orient Express. I mean, like, that's... You want to talk about a perfect ending of a film? Not only the fact that they're on the Orient Express, but they are recreating that postcard that has been such, like, a horcrux of this film.
is
awesome. Like, it's beautiful filmmaking. And
if I could put my hope out there for a sequel, I think the joke about the French detective coming to New York and them having to get him out of trouble for being falsely accused of something, I feel like that would be a phenomenal...
It'd be murder, excellent, murder mystery, right?
Of him. It speaks to Transporter 2 in a lot of ways that I really love, the ways in which they use the French detective in that one as the guy that comes to him with the problem in the second one. There's a lot of elements that I would really love about that particular story. Here I am talking about like wanting to see more of these characters and really enjoying my time with it when I watched it a second time, and I'm also really happy because I'm happy that I enjoyed a Sandler movie again that is not in the cinematic universe. After the one movie that I really felt like I didn't enjoy so far was Just Go With It, and it not being one of the verse ones was like, oh, maybe I'm not going to love it if we step out of the bounds. But no, I can still enjoy myself even if we get out of our safe, comfy zone.
Yeah, it really speaks to just the strength of Sandler as an actor, but then also Jennifer Aniston, which is not surprising, but... She can have fun too. and that is, she is having a blast on this film. There's no way that she's like, oh God, I gotta go work against Adam today. There are moments, like again, this film legitimately in a lot of ways feels like her movie.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think the big thing is she's sort of acting as an audience XB for the thousands of white women who are suddenly obsessed with murder podcasts in 2019.
Yeah.
But it's what it is. Last question. Does donut really represent vagina in emojis? Or like, is that just a swing and a miss in that scene?
Maybe this just speaks more to my social life, but I am much more familiar with the eggplant and then peach to represent one's bottom.
Yeah, shall we say. That's what I thought.
That is much more the ways in which I've seen that really be expressed. But you know, I don't know what the kids do.
Donut made me think of a very specific hole that peach does not make me think of.
Man.
And I think on that's pretty, I think we're good, right? Is there anything else that you want to add that you didn't get to say about Murder Mystery?
No, phenomenal cast. Like we really didn't give enough shout out to like the side characters. I mean, we talked about them, but really, I mean, Gemma Arterton, I never say her last name correct. Terrence Stamp. I mean, we talked about Luke Evans, but like, David Williams, it's so good. The whole group of them is just a blast. So it was also really interesting to see such a strong ensemble that was not the Sandler ensemble. Really interesting to see Sandler in there. And I think in a lot of ways really kind of helped feed the whole fish out of water story that you're supposed to get with the Spitz, right? Like, and to see Sandler surrounded by a group of people that were not his people was actually jarring in a lot of moments. And I think purposely so. So just, you know, it was just a really cool element.
There's that beautiful moment where he's like, they're like, we can go. And he's like, no, stay. And then he continues and is just ripping into the people who are at the party to celebrate he's newly married. Yeah. And they're like, man, we would not have gotten this on the bus tour. And they're just like having a full-on conversation with each other. Like, that would really lose some of the weight of it if David Spade was playing the son. And right. Kevin James was the bodyguard to
Henry Winkler was the grandfather, right?
Like that's the thing. Like, and he comes out, and I'm like, is it gonna be Henry Winkler? Because he had Henry Winkler's hair, like from but from the behind. I'm like, but it's English. It's gonna be an actor from England. And then it's Terrence Stamp, and I'm like, yeah, I would have never guessed Terrence Stamp. Of all of the possible people who could be playing Malcolm Quince.
One night of filming on a very beautiful boat out on what I no doubt on location on the Mediterranean. Like that's how you get Terrence Stamp to be in this movie. And like, that's the other thing. Super intelligently made in order to get this kind of work done with these people. Like, you can give all the shit in the world you want to these vacation style films. I mean, hell, Just Go With It was 1-2 and they all went to Hawaii. Right. But like the ways in which using that in order to make a movie in which you can get like Luke Evans as your third lead is pretty fucking ballsy of Sandler. Like, I love it. I think it should be applauded.
I know. Also, it's just great to see Luke Evans in things. I love Luke Evans. And thank you for putting Luke Evans in this movie, Adam Sandler. All right. I think that's it. Yeah, just sing the praise of that. Also, I want to sing out one beautiful moment in this is that when the car crashes at the end, it knocks down what has to have been a newly minted statue of Malcolm Quince. Because it has his life and death dates on it. And like, it's never mentioned. It's purely a visual gag, but it really works.
Yeah.
For me. And then I guess it doesn't work that Nick stole the Charles Cavendish's clothes off of his dead body. That's going to haunt me going to bed for a couple of weeks. That, like,
oh my God.
And that they both fit in the same suit.
The way that this would have gone in a verse in a Sandler verse film, they would have then shown like the Luke Evans dead body in like tidy whities, right? Like that would have been you would have seen that visual.
You would have seen him naked from behind, and she would be like, "Why'd you take off his underwear?" And he's like, "He wasn't wearing any underwear." Imagine that, huh? You're taking down the pants. Oh God.
Oh man.
I'm sorry. You know what? There, right there, right? The final talk about Just Go With It and Murder Mystery is there would be those scenes that would firmly push them into the landscape of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. If we actually saw him break it off with Brooke Decker at their wedding, or if we actually saw him undress Luke Evans,
yeah.
That would have been a bridge too far. For these films to be, I'm going to say legitimate. That's the word that comes to mind when I look at these two films. Not to say that the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe films that we've looked at, the ones that we say there are illegitimate films, but they don't have the broad appeal.
Yeah, it's a loaded term, but we're all friends here. I get you.
Yeah. All right. So that's the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. Sijin and I also do another podcast called The Say Report. That one's about everything. So if you've liked this hyper-focused on Adam Sandler, maybe you'd like us with broader appeal. And if you would like to point out some of your own favorite vacation films, you can get in touch with Sijin directly at Siege vs. the World on Twitter. And I bet he'd like to hear about it.
And if you've got any other murder mystery comedies, I should say, because there's a lot of like horror comedies, and that's not what I mean. But you can definitely hit Devin up at Devin D. Deckard. Maybe we'll watch them together.
Yeah, I do. I'd love to hear about more. Like, this is apparently a genre I love, and I think I've only ever seen two of them, and that's Being Generous. And the other one is the sequel to Stakeout, and I might just be misremembering the sequel to Stakeout.
With Emilio Estevez?
Yeah, with Emilio Estevez.
Emilio! Yeah, man.
All right, so until next time, just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good night, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.